Sounds like they're playing our song. K2RIW. K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. At this time, we begin the technet as we've done. Dick?
Yes, sir?
Okay, I just pulled into the parking lot at Glen Oaks, so... I'm going to be fixing a couple of things, so I'm going to be interrupting you at various points along this, so don't get too upset.
I'm getting upset, make a rough guess. Are you going to be interrupting us a half hour, an hour and a half into the net? Give me a rough guess, Eric, go ahead.
It'll probably take me another 10 minutes to go downstairs to security and get signed in, and then another 5 minutes to get upstairs, and then we'll start looking. This receiver doesn't seem to be working too well. I'm going to have the link issue to deal with. And right now the IOP is not on, so there's probably, actually now that I'm not moving, I can get on my cell phone and connect that up, and there's probably a bunch of folks in Canada and a few other places. So give me a second, let me bring them up.
Roger. For those who are listening, the technical net tonight's going to have a delayed start. Eric, KE2HA, KE2 Echo Juliet, is our chief engineer, and he's doing some testing and repairs at this time. We'll be standing by.
Yeah, contact.
Dick Antorio, can you possibly put me up first? I want to give a little talk on FastScan Amateur TV, and I want to see if there's any interest within the club, Roger.
I recommend, Rich, that you do not do that first. The number of people signing in and listening grows downrange. You have the minimum number of people up front. So you'll be talking to the minimum number of people if you do it first.
Okay. Well, just let me know when it would be good.
Dick, I'm going to turn the inputs off for a minute because the system won't come up while people are talking.
Roger.
I DeLauto Connect enabled. Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
All right, Dick, you got a good 15 minutes before I start bothering you. Go ahead.
Roger, Eric. Okay, with a delayed start of the TechNet, this is TechNet number 1614 of the series that began way back in September of 1982, 32 and a fraction, almost 33 years ago. 33? No, it's going on 34 years ago. 33 and a fraction years ago. A lot of water under the bridge since then. Quite possibly this is one of the longest running nets under the same leadership for 34 years. It may be one of the longest running nets because it runs 4 hours each week. So the total number of hours the TechNet has existed is well over 5,000 hours. More hours than Johnny Carson has been on Channel 4 television during his 30 years of the Tonight Show. The main purpose of the TechNet, you guys have heard it so often, is that we gather curious amateurs who want to know more about radio and wireless technology. How does it work? How to make it work better? Why does my transmission line and my antenna behave that way? What is propagation like? Does 32 or 33, some big number like that, total number of kinds of ham radio? Let's call it the 26 to 27 kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of them. This particular repeater is equipped with Echo Link, IRLP, chat room. So we do get people listening from quite a few states, quite a few countries, and sometimes they decide to sign in from those out of area places. Let me drop. There's a very loose schedule that we follow. The first hour, we take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. And they check in giving us their name, their call letters, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or comment. You need not check in because you're listening. After 33 years, we believe somebody is listening. It's not to be proved to us anymore. And almost everybody who's got a net says, if there's any emergency traffic, speak up right now. I don't know why they do that. There never is any. So we don't do that. At first hour, we take questions and comments. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, our mailbag expert. So people who don't yet have the right license or the right equipment to talk to us directly, they send some kind of a message to John, and he'll be giving you his website. And his website's also listed at QRZ.com. So you send him your question, and John chooses 2, 3, or 4 of those. Sometimes we're getting questions from guys in electrical engineering school giving us their homework assignment, if you know what I mean. But if it's good radio, it doesn't matter where it comes from. Let me drop it. After John makes that presentation of a few mailbag entries, Paul WS2N is our space expert, and he keeps track of what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, the European Space Agency, the Southern European Observatory, the Japan agencies. He spent a good fraction of his life studying everything that you can study about space that you can find out on the Internet. He brings us up to speed on that. Although it's kind of corny, I keep asking him the greatest DX piece of hardware that mankind has ever issued, the Voyager spacecraft out there 3 times the distance to Pluto, 12 billion miles away. I keep asking him every week, what's the health of Voyager? How fast is it traveling? And how far is it? Right now, at the speed of light, from that distance, it takes 37 hours round-trip time for you to say hello, Voyager, and for Voyager to say hello right back to you immediately. 37 hours at the speed of light. All that with a 10-watt transmitter. That's a QRP from the number of... That number of miles per watt is, let's see, 10 watts, 12 billion miles. That's 1.2 billion miles per watt. My goodness, is that DX? And we have reason to believe that NASA is going to continue talking to Voyager for maybe as much as 10 more years. It'll keep telling us what it sees out there as it leaves the solar system and is now entering the plasma of the galaxy, if you know what I mean. They can tell because the wind it's seeing, the solar wind from the sun, has essentially stopped and is now seeing galactic wind coming at it from some other direction, and it's reporting that information. Let me drop. Along the way, quite often Hal, K6DPZ, gives the benefit of his many years of radio exposure. So that's the loose schedule. And I say loose because there are times if there are a few questions, the first section doesn't last an hour. If there's some real exciting questions, we go with the flow. And there are times in the first section lasts for 2 hours. And there are people who get very upset by that, the fact that we don't follow a schedule. Hey, we're doing what people want. There are people who complain a little bit that the TechNet sometimes is exciting and sometimes boring. for the most part, that crew of people, me, John, Paul, and Hal, we do not plan on what's being discussed most of the time. The subject being discussed are the questions you guys ask. So if it's not interesting enough, then maybe somebody hasn't asked interesting enough questions. Sometimes the mundane, basic information is still worth going over because it's not always easy to understand. The questions that are appropriate for the TechNet are any questions representing a subject of interest to radio amateurs. Of course, the big question is, what the hell is of interest to radio amateurs? And from my point of view, a real ham, there's a scientist inside there trying to get out, and he's interested in radio, radio astronomy, optical astronomy, astrophysics, sometimes blondes and brunettes, but sometimes automobiles, but we get into quite a few subjects. Try to relate it all to radio, though, of course. And there's no such thing as a dumb question. Don't be embarrassed. You don't have to say that, hey, my question may be too simple. You don't even have to say that.
Hey, KNH.
Sounds like Kilo Delta 2, Kilo November Hotel. Correct me if I'm wrong and tell us your name, sir. KQRIW.
Call sign is correct. Name is Charlie.
Very fine, Charlie. Okay, we've got Rich, Joe, Bill, and Charlie. One last call. Anyone else to check in because they do have a question or a comment for the net? K2RIW listening. Give us your call letters and name right now.
Did Charlie say he had a question?
I think he did. But we'll soon find out. Joe, KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Go right ahead, Joe. You're number one on the runway. K2RIW listening.
Roger, Roger. Yeah, sorry about that. My question to you is, do they make, I'm talking about batteries, you know, like the regular DEC, AAA, AA batteries. Is there a company out there where they make batteries so they don't leak, you know, into your, like say, your flashlight or your digital recorder, so forth and so forth? That's my question to you, Dick. Back to you, Dick.
As I see that, Joe, is a yes and a no to that question. Back in the old days of carbon zinc batteries, at the end of life, they would all leak magnesium dioxide or whatever the heck that chemical was in the electrolyte. They would all leak. For the last zillion years, almost all batteries are in sealed containers. And in theory, they do not leak. In theory. But there's a catch. Almost any battery, if you allow it to go dead and sit in your flashlight for the next 5 years, even though it's got an extra steel case around it protecting you from its chemistry, eventually it'll eat through that case also. So can you buy a battery that has absolutely no leakage for the next 10 years? I doubt it. I doubt it highly. But you just have to be a little bit careful. Know full well that your battery, if you leave it too long, particularly after it goes dead, something about the battery going dead where it likes eating through its case, even its outer steel protective case. So I think you're eventually going to get leakage if you wait long enough. I'm looking at a lithium battery. Let me drop. I'm looking at a lithium battery that I just took out of my Kenwood TS-811, my 450 all-mode rig, which I think was built roughly 1990. I believe this is the original battery. The service manual, the owner's manual, says that the battery is expected to be lasting at least 5 years, and it's supposed to be replaced by a skilled person recommended by the factory. That was the owner's manual saying it. Well, 1990 to now is 26 years, so that battery's been in there for 26 years. And it finally went dead a month ago. And when it goes dead, that's the memory battery. It's a 3.2 volt or 3.3 volt lithium battery, 3/4 inch in diameter, 1/8 inch thick, with leads coming out of the sides, and sitting above the main printed circuit board when you open up the top case on that rig. And that lithium battery, I've never seen that before, but this lithium battery, after 26 years, ate through its case, and it's showing a powdery white material on the upper metal surface of that battery. And when it comes to the memory batteries and Kenwood rigs, let me drop. If you go back to Kenwood, in theory, you can order any of those parts that you want from Kenwood. And they don't ship them to you directly. They ship them to East Coast Transistor in Hempstead, the name of the company. And I went there to pick up the batteries. And they've got them. Also, I hear tell that DigiKey stores that exact same battery. The exact same battery is obtainable in bubble packs on Home Depot and stores like that without the tabs. That's the problem. And there's no good way of putting those tabs on there. I don't recommend you solder tabs onto a lithium battery, bringing the case up to the heat. That way you can put solder on it. It's probably going to give you some damage. The leads that are there were done with very fast spot welding. So that battery, that's the first time I've ever seen a lithium battery leak, but it took 26 years to happen. So as you can tell, Joe, my every one of the batteries you buy nowadays is protected to some degree, but not for an infinite degree. Now, drag your feet in case other battery experts are listening. They're going to give us their benefit of their knowledge. KC2QIW with some delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think that battery is called a CR203.
U.S. Swan.
Okay, Paul recognized. Rich, thank you. CR203. I think the owner's manual did not tell me that. It told me that it has to be replaced, that it should be considered replacing it after 5 years. And so when I called up Eastern Transistor, I just told them I want a battery for a Kenwood 711, 811. They knew what I was talking about. And I asked them how many they had in stock. They had six. I said, I'm going to buy three of them, and I'll be there to see you in a few hours. And when I got there, the person I talked to says, no, we don't have that battery. Well, thank goodness the guy over the wall heard me talking. He said, yeah, I'm the guy you talk to. I've got the batteries. Come on over here. So let's see what Paul's got to say. I wonder if you've ever replaced those batteries, Paul. WS2N, our space expert, K2IW. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, I did once on the Kenwood 440. And at the time, another ham recommended a good idea, but I didn't do it because I was able to get this one from DigiKey. And it's probably the same one that you have, the one with leads that are soldered directly to the case. But he had a good idea. You go over to Radio Shack. Nowadays, maybe you can't do this because of the shape that Radio Shack is in, but they used to have a little battery holder that would hold those same size batteries. He said, and they have leads off of it, off the case. He said, solder those on. Just leave it external, you know, tape it to, use double stick tape or something, stick it to the body of the radio, and if it ever happens again, just pull out the existing battery and put another one in for the memory. Sounded like a good idea, but I wound up getting it. It was inexpensive, I think $11 back, probably about 15 years ago. So that was well worth it. So I just got the one with the leads. Back to you, Dick.
Now, most likely the lithium battery, 3/4 inch diameter, 1/8 inch thick, with welded leads, spot welded leads. They're not soldered, they're spot welded. You can't solder to that battery. But spot welding creates very little heat and no damage. And most likely a CR203. And when I bought them from Eastern Transistor, they were $6 a piece. Now, when you said $11 or $12, Paul, are you talking about the battery plus the battery holder from Radio Shack? Or are you telling me what DigiKey charged you for the battery? And quite possibly DigiKey not only sells you exactly that battery with those leads, but maybe DigiKey will also sell you the that size battery holder. I'll bet you DigiKey somewhere in their catalog got it. So give us some more information on those ambiguities, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That was the cost of the battery. Only the battery with the leads. The cost of the holder, I don't know what it would have been. I didn't go that route. It sounded good, but then once I found out DigiKey even existed, that what a good company that was. That was it. I went that way. But I could see this becoming annoying if that thing quit on a regular basis. But since it's only happened one time since 1986, I guess I'm due now. It'll probably happen again as I'm speaking. Back to you, Dick.
Amazing. 1986, if I did the math right, is 30 years ago. And I guess you're saying your 440 rig, that memory battery died in the last few months. Is that what you're saying, Paul? So yours lasted almost 30 years? Impressive. And I bet you've used that radio quite a bit, too. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, that's my only HF transceiver, but not it lasted half that time. About 15 years ago, this happened when I had to get the new battery. So, you know, half that time. That's why I'm saying I'm probably due now. Yeah, but, you know, originally I think people were saying at the time they'd be happy if you got 10 years. And I'm into the 15-year category, so they do last a long time. I often wonder, maybe when you have the radio on, maybe it's putting a little charge into that battery. There's got to be something. It just can't be just that amount of power that's going to last that long. I think it's taking a charge, but I don't know that. Back to you.
Yes, I would have a 1 megohm resistor going up to a +5 or +15 volt supply, giving you a few microamps of current, which wouldn't be charging, even though a lithium battery is not intended to be recharged. Just a small amount of holding current would have to be something that would be beneficial. Whenever I studied the schematic diagram that was supplied with my owner's manual, I cannot find that battery on the schematic. Maybe I'm blind and just didn't find it. And I think at one time I owned the service manual for Kenwood 711, or 811. And I misplaced that if I did have the service manual. I know I've got the service manual for the 751 Kenwood. That's a 2-meter all-mode, also a mobile rig. So I'd like to find that battery on the schematic. And I still wouldn't be sure whether or not there's a charging circuit in there, because it's connected directly to the phase lock loop memory chip, and possibly the memory chip has a 1 megohm resistor inside that's doing the charging, if you know what I mean. Okay, so I think you can't depend on any. Yep, I'm still hearing the delay on 375, and I'm hearing a tiny bit of echo on 85. So you got to be careful with batteries, and don't think you can buy a battery with a perfect shielding. He's tapping on the rig with perfect shielding that has no leakage forever. I don't think you can depend on that, Joe, because every battery's got exotic chemistry. That's where all the power is coming from. And you wait long enough, it's going to eat itself through that case, no matter how thick the case is. KC2QIW. K2IW with a bunch of opinions. Over to you, Joe.
Yeah, roger, roger. Yeah, because it did happen to me on one of my, my other hobby is building, remote control gas cars. 1/8 skill, 1/8 skill gas cars. Buggies and on-road and off-road buggies and whatnot. And, I left Alkin, I think it's called Airsol Alkin. And I left it in one of the, remote control, the controller box. And, when I opened it, sure enough, One of the batteries leaked out, and I was able to save the controller. I took it out and I cleaned it up. So now I know in the future to take them out. All right, I'll pass it back to the net, and love you guys, and thank you very much.
NY2HF with a comment.
NY2HF. Dennis, go right ahead with your comment, and I hope you're able to tolerate all that delay you're getting out there on 375, which I think is what you have to use. You got it, Dennis.
Actually, Dick, no delay. It all sounds good. The only thing I wanted to add was with batteries, you really want to change them before the recommended time, because it's when they get discharged that they start to acidify. If you think about your smoke detectors, your carbon monoxide detectors, they say change them every year, because after a year, they're so well discharged that if you leave them in much longer and they're in a weakened condition, that's when they start to leak the, I guess it's sulfur or whatever it is. It's the white powder that destroys all the connections. So that's only my 2 cents, and back to Ned.
Very fine, Dennis. I think you're right. Yeah, if we're going to be conservative, to replace before it goes dead is a smart thing to do. Thank goodness our modern-day rigs do not have a dynamic memory system where the main computer program is being held up by a battery. There were a few years back in the late 70s where rigs were built that way. And when the battery went dead, every knob on the front paddle became useless. The whole rig became useless until you sent it back to Kenwood or ICOM or whoever rebuilt it. And they put in a new battery and reprogrammed it. Thank goodness we're not doing that anymore. That was a really ugly period of time where many of our rigs at that period developed a bad memory, a bad reputation. Does anybody know the model numbers of some of the rigs that had that characteristic so that we can know to be a little bit wary of them in the future? If you know the rig numbers, Kenwood, ICOM, or Yaesu, model number so-and-so, has the dynamic memory of the main computer operating program being held up with a battery, give me a call that is right now, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KTUPS, mobile tech. I don't have the model numbers, but I just have another comment on the batteries.
Go right ahead, Rich. Start off telling us where you are. I'm going to guess you're in Pennsylvania. I'm going to guess you're west, eastbound. And there's a 50-50 chance I've got it. So tell us what you... Hey, you do a lot of battery operating, Rich. So tell us your wisdom about batteries. K2, Uncle Papa Sierra, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, yeah, I am eastbound, but I'm still in Ohio. I haven't hit West Virginia yet. The two comments. One is you can get batteries that have a 10-year shelf life warranty to guarantee from the manufacturer that Duracell. I forget the particular name that they give them, but they are Duracell alkaline batteries. They're supposed to hold the charge for 10 years. So, you know, if you're putting batteries in something, you might want to check on that. You know, if you buy real cheap dollar store batteries, they might leak a lot faster. But I think if they have a shelf life of 10 years, they're going to hold up longer for you, even in use. And the other comment was with the, just trying to think, I had two things about batteries. One of the AA's, the smoke detectors. I just recently replaced some smoke detectors in my house with very small units. They're small cylinders, almost the size of a golf ball. I believe they were made by Kitty, and I think the model name was the Atom, the Kitty Atom. They have a lithium battery in there that's good for 10 years. So to put these things up, you don't even see them, and you do not change these things every year like you always used to do. That was it. Back to that.
Now, the Kitty Atom battery, if it looks like a golf ball, that doesn't sound to me like it's going to fit into your smoke detector or carbon monoxide detector. So tell me how you put that battery in there, Rich, and then I'll pick up the other person. KTUPS, K2IW.
K2J Alpha.
Okay, Dick, no, that Kitty Atom is the entire unit, battery, smoke detector, everything, all in one very small package. It's not the battery that you put into a unit you already have. This is a completely separate unit, non-replaceable battery. When you put it up, it's good for 10 years.
Very fine, Rich. Good information. Okay, the person who signed in just before, Eric, we said he had a comment. Give us your full call, your name, and then your comment, sir, K2RIW. Also, give us a little more audio.
NY2HF. Whiskey Bravo, who's off that 3 months, switch.
Okay, we got Whiskey Bravo, Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf, X-ray Mike. I think his name was Rich. We also picked up Dennis. Go ahead, Rich, with your comment.
You were talking about rigs which had the dynamic memory problem. And it's well known that the ICOM IC751, 751A, and the IC71A receiver
all had dynamic memory supported by a battery, and the unit went dead when the battery was used. So that in modern times, you can get modern replacement for non-volatile RAM made by Triac and Wilco, W-I-L-L-C-O.
Okay, WB2GXM told us that the ICOM 751 and 751A had that dynamic memory. And you can buy a printed circuit board from Blank Company, which I didn't hear, and Wilco. W-I-L-L-C-O. Rich, your audio is 10 decibels too low. Your RF is also right at the margin where you're dropping in and dropping out. All right, we're going to go to the next person that was on the list, was Eric, K-E-2-E-J. Go right ahead, Eric, K-2-L-I-W.
Jay, Truth Thing. One, when it comes to batteries, there's a number of batteries that are guaranteed not to leak. And that's only if they have a charge in them. Once they get fully discharged, they leak, if they keep them around for a bunch of years. But I'm about to measure the sensitivity of the receiver up here. So you've got to give me 2 minutes.
Okay, let me pick up Dennis first, and then you can do your test. NY2HF, K2RIW, go ahead, Dennis, with your comment.
Thank you, Nick Control. Actually, I was going to ditto Eric's slant on this, where it's not that the batteries are 10 years, and they will last probably 10 years. It's the amount of discharge, and that's when they start to break down. It's only after you start using them. So be very wary of a battery that you have maybe a year or two into use. It's going to start to break down and corrode everything that you that it is attached to. And I'll hand it back to the net.
Okay, I thank you, Dennis. All righty, now, Eric is doing some maintenance on the repeater, so we'll be standing by for a few minutes while he measures sensitivity. And after that period of time, we'll be picking up Bill, WB2CUK. So, not yet, Bill. Eric, KE2UJ? KE2EJ. All yours, Eric.
Give me a minute here. Okay, Dick, so yours.
Dick? Sounds like you were doing a 1 kilohertz 12 dB SINAD measurement. Did you get something close to a quarter of a microvolt, which I guess would be, 12 dB more than 107, 119 dBm minus, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, let's see, it's a little thick. I'm doing about minus 115 where it ends up, and almost minus 100 where I get, where I get my cyanide.
So I think you're saying 12 dB cyanide with minus 100? That does sound a little low in sensitivity. Is that what you assessed also, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, it opens at 0.5. It's full quieting at like 2 microvolts, which is, these receivers do a lot better than this. So. And unfortunately, I forgot to bring the damn extender board with me, so I ain't going to be adjusting it tonight. Thank goodness it's a very short trip for you to go back. That's a joke. I think I heard ORS. Was that you, Bob? Go ahead.
Walk into us, Alex.
Okay, I think it was Mark. Go ahead, Mark.
Good evening, everybody. Yeah, Dick, those Duracell batteries are called Quantum. They are good for 10 years. Got a pack sitting here. Had it here for 3 years and haven't opened them yet. And they're good till 2023. Anyway, also, I wanted to ask you about that PIEX board for that radio you had, or your friend's radio with the memory. Did it work out for you?
Okay, Mark, PIEX board, memory, radio. I wonder if you confuse me with somebody else, go ahead.
Negative, negative. We spoke about him, my God, geez, a month or so ago now. He had a radio, or a friend has a radio, which lost its memory due to the battery had died, you know, one of those 70 radios.
Okay. My Kenwood TS-811 had its CR-203 battery, lithium battery, die, and therefore it could no longer hold the things that I programmed into it, but it wasn't the main operating system. And I did replace that battery yesterday, and that was very successful. Somehow I suspect that's not what you're talking about. Back to you, Mark.
Hey, listen, my memory's shot too sometimes, I tell you. No, we were talking about, like, the IC-745 HF radio. I told you I had that radio, and I was able to get that PIEX board before the battery died, just swap it out. And I think it was a friend's radio you were working on, if I remember correctly. Well, it's not that important, but I'm just curious. Back to the net in 2FLF.
Yeah, both PIEX makes a replacement for that crazy dynamic memory thing, as well as this other company that was brought to our attention tonight. Wilco. So PIEX and Wilco, or Wilco, is a company that will sell you a board. All right, Bill. Bill's up at bat. WB2CUK, the man who runs the swapping shop on Limark. And I bet you've been doing that for 25 years or something like that, Bill. Is that true? WB2CUK, K2IW, and you said you got a question right up my alley. I'll discuss anything except antennas. Over to you, Bill. I'm having fun with him.
Good evening, Dick. Yeah, I guess I've been running this swap shop a long time. Here's my question. You probably have a collection of rubber duck antennas floating around the house, all different sizes and shapes. Well, I got a bunch too. Let me try to figure out analytically which one gives you the best performance. Well, I have an idea. I just wanted to run a test here. I picked up a couple of these cable TV tester boxes that are calibrated in TVM, one digital and one analog, and they tune through the amp. The signal coming from an HT, say, maybe. Different antennas. My question is, what would be better, keeping a constant antenna on the HD or a constant antenna on the sensing box that I'm using to figure out the best antenna? Where would the antenna under test best be situated, on the box or on the signal source?
Okay, Bill's signal was quite noisy. I was hearing him on the input. So I'll repeat his question. He's got a whole bunch of rubber duck antennas, and he wants to test them. And one of his questions is, should the rubber duck under test be used in the transmit mode or the receive mode? That's one of the questions. and he's going to transmit from one handy turkey or from one signal generator, doesn't matter which, and then measuring signal strength at some distance through a rubber duck that's either receiving or transmitting at some other distance. Very logical test to do, and you think you're testing the performance of a rubber duck. Unfortunately, you're not. Let me drop. In the very early days of rubber duck antennas, they were made out of nichrome wire, resistive wire, because the radios in those days couldn't tolerate very much transmitting standing wave ratio, so you intentionally made the antenna somewhat resistively lossy. In so doing, the rubber duck, no matter what end of the band you're at, the low end or the high end, whether on 2 meters or 450, if you've made the antenna out of nichrome wire, it's very easy to make a resistive, lossy antenna have a fairly good standing wave ratio at almost all frequencies. The ham soon found out about that and started complaining that, hey, this rubber duck is getting hot and it's lossy. So we've insisted that rubber ducks be made out of copper-like materials, and none of our rubber ducks have any loss. Okay. All of our rubber duck antennas, by definition, are less than a quarter wavelength long because they're a spiral wound. Any antenna that is physically less than a quarter wavelength long cannot have more than the gain of a ground plane antenna or a half of a dipole antenna. In other words, the gain of that antenna under the most ideal conditions is fixed, because gain of an antenna is a constant times its effective area. When you can't make an antenna, let me drop it. You can't make an antenna have more than a half wavelength of effective area without developing more than a half wavelength of physical space, the tip-to-tip distance on your antenna. If you want more real gain, it has to physically be more than a half wavelength long for you to get that. A 5/8 wave can do that. But a quarter wave, like rubber duck, no way in hell. If it's low in loss because it's made out of low loss materials, copper materials, then the gain is an exact number of essentially that what you're going to get of a ground plane antenna. The big catch is that each manufacturer of a handy talkie has his favorite output impedance of the transmitter and his favorite input impedance of the receiver. Therefore, he designs a rubber duck that matches that impedance. Every antenna, in order for an antenna to work well, you resonate it first, and then it will radiate. So if you use the wrong rubber duck on the wrong handy talkie, quite possibly you're out of resonance and you will get low performance. Are you getting low performance because the rubber duck is bad? Absolutely not. You've chosen the wrong rubber duck for the wrong radio. Let me drop. And if that combination doesn't hit resonance, you'll get low performance. You'll think the rubber duck is bad. It's not. And I'm hearing some tapping. And the tapping's working very well, Eric. Let's see if Eric wants to say something to us. KE2EJ, K2RAW. Go ahead, Eric, if you want to.
No, I'm just moving stuff around. I'm working on the link transmitter.
Anytime you want to break in, all you've got to do is do that tapping. It comes out very loud in my earphones, and I know you want to talk to us. So if you want to run a further test, just do that tapping. So there was another guy who was a substantial person in the Lockfield Amateur Radio Club, or was it the Grumman Club, who built himself a great big ground plane, and he put a connector on it, and then he took a zillion different rubber ducks, mounted on the ground plane, and tried to make gain measurements. And what that person had forgot, what almost all of us forget, is that if you read the rules of the road for antenna testing, dictated by the Antennas and Propagation Society of the IEEE, the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, have this separate society called Antennas and Propagation, AP, with a monthly journal, and I'm a life member of that group, and arguably it's the antenna experts worldwide, with zillions and zillions of those pages of those monthly journals filling up my house. The Antennas and Propagation Society says that gain is that performance you measure of an antenna after you have perfectly impedance matched it. Let me drop.
So, you know, you want to comment?
Stand by, Howie. So you got to you've got a first impedance matcher, which is more than just resonating it. You want to match the resistive component and the reactive component. So now, if you really wanted to measure the performance and efficiency of your rubber duck antennas, you would start off with a nice big ground plane, because you don't want the size of the case of the handy talkie to be one of the variables. That's not what you're trying to evaluate. You're trying to evaluate the performance of rubber ducks. You could start off with a great big large ground plane with the right kind of connector that the rubber duck will go into. On the other side of that ground plane will be an impedance matching device, like a double stub tuner. So you'll use the double stub tuner to perfectly impedance match that antenna, and then whether you use it in the receive mode or the transmit mode doesn't matter, because almost all rubber ducks, with, except for the 5/8 wave ones that we sometimes use, let me drop. Since almost all of them are physically less than a half wave long, the laws of physics dictate it cannot have more than a dipole of gain. So the gain number you're going to get from that physical length is fixed. The only thing you'll be measuring when you impedance match each one of those rubber ducks and then measure its transmitting performance or receiving performance, you'll measure whether or not there's any resistive coating on that wire of that rubber duck. So you've got a very logical sounding test that you were about to do, as I see it, Bill. But because there is a minefield out there that each of these rubber ducks are either more inductive or more capacitive, because that's the way the transmitter or the receiver of that handy talkie worked out, and that manufacturer designed his rubber duck to work with his rig. And so they're all a little bit different for that reason. And so that's going to throw you a curve. WB2C UK, I wonder if some of that made some sense, Bill. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess the best way would be to mount different antennas on the transmitting radio, see which one is received the strongest at my test site, and that would basically be the best one. I have to go. It's getting towards bedtime for the wife here. I have one little comment about the battery situation. You might find cutting up little pieces of aluminum foil and putting them on the tips of the battery and turn the base before you put them in. Try and get that in between the contacts. So if it does leak, it'll protect the expensive radio that it sends. And I have that radio. And I've never noticed the battery going bad, but I have a couple of years, so I'll have to make sure that it's good. I got to go, but thanks for your information there. This is WB2, so UK, going to be clear.
Yeah, very fine, Bill. When that lithium battery is in good shape, when it's brand new, it gives you 3.28 volts. If you measure something like 3 to 3.2 volts out of your lithium battery, make sure you don't create a short circuit while making that measurement, then most likely it's in fairly good shape for a while, it says here. Putting aluminum foil on the contacts or around the battery to protect it from the acid, I think that's going to give you only a limited amount of extra performance, extra protection, because I think the chemistry in a battery, when it decides to really do a good job of leaking, I think it'll eat right through your aluminum foil, is my belief, but I'm not sure about that one. So when you now put the right rubber duck on the right handy talkie and you measure performance, each handy talkie, although they're all rated for 5 watts of output, some of them put out 3 watts, some of them put out 6 watts, depending on whether you've got the 8-volt battery or the 13-volt battery connected to them. So there's another variable involved there, Bill. It's not an easy test to do. On top of that, no matter how you set up the test, you're almost likely, you're almost always going to have multipath. Let me drop. So there's going to be a signal bouncing off the ground, off the walls, off the person holding it. And so to really make sure that each individual handy-talkie is being put into the exact same condition when you make the measurement is another great big variable. But I think you're doing a little bit of an experiment in frustration, Bill, because I think the simplest thing you could do is to take a sharp pin, pierce through the rubber in one little spot on your rubber duck antenna, so that you're making contact with the upper end, and you also have the connector at the lower end, and put your ohm meter across it. If it passes the ohmmeter test, you've now got a high-performance rubber duck. There's no way it can have loss if it passed the ohmmeter test. You'd be confirming that it's not made out of nichrome wire. And so the radio test beyond that, I'm not sure it's really going to tell you something that you didn't already know. That's a bunch of opinions. Let's see if what Howie's got to say. WB2HWW, K2LIW. Go ahead, Howie.
Good afternoon. Good evening. Two things. Dick, most of your modern-day radios present a 50-ohm load. They don't play games like that. It's not like the old days where a 220 might have 90 ohms and other radios had different impedances. Today, most of it, and I think the best way to test these antennas is to actually test them by using them. I mean, you're right. To make an exact measurement, it's probably hard. You need a chamber, and, you know, an antenna chamber or an antenna, you know, an antenna range, as they would call it. But I think the best way to check an antenna is to use the radio with your hand and walk around under real conditions, because, you know, a lot of cases they use the person at the ground plane, or they assume that the antenna will be so many feet above height. So, you know, you try different antennas. Some of these antennas work well. I find that most of the antennas that come with the HTs, like the Yaesu's or Kenwood's, you're better off buying a Comet or a Diamond Rubber Duck. They do a lot better. So most of the antennas...
RC210, repeater, controller, V6.045. The time is 8:59 p.m. The time is 8:59 p.m. Ready.
You copy my last transmission, Dick?
We sure did, Eric. I mean, Howie, don't worry. And, without a doubt, the handy-talkie, in theory, is designed to have a human hand holding onto it, and that hand presents a certain amount of capacitance to the metal case that's inside of that plastic case that your hand is touching. And so the counterpoise for the antenna, the way it's designed, includes the human being. And when you go to the Satomo company, for instance, which makes a very high-performance kind of an antenna range, Satomo, if you Google those words, S-A-T-I-M-O, I think it's a French company, they have a standard hand and a standard body of a human being that you literally put into the chamber when you're testing a handheld device like a cell phone or a handy-talkie in order to really put it under working conditions. So there's more variables here than meets the eye. Good luck with that test, Bill, if you do decide to go forward with it. Let me drop it. The next person on our list, if he does have a question, and there we're not sure, is Charlie, Kilo Delta 2, Kilo November Hotel. So if you had a question, Charlie, now is your time. And even if you didn't have a question, you're allowed to ask one anyhow. K2KNH, KD2KNH, K2LIW. You got it, Charlie. Okay. Maybe Charlie didn't have a question. And Rich, Rich wants to propose a 1200 megacycle television system. And so at this time, we usually have a maximum number of people signing in and listening to the TechNet. So go ahead, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Good evening, everybody. Yes, I wanted to talk about ATV, better known as amateur television. Not to be confused with slow scan, which they run like on 20 meters and 80 meters. Those are still pictures over there. Fast scan ATV can be legally run on all bands above 440 megahertz. And it's moving pictures with sound, just like what you see on your regular TV screen. Now, there's a company out there, I'm going to reset. I've been doing a lot of research on the internet. The company is called Mini Kits. Mini Kits